Hello and welcome to Max Politics. This is Ben Max coming to you from New York Law School and its Center for New York City Law. Thanks very much for tuning in for the show today. It's Friday, April 12th, 2024. The New York State budget continues to be late. The state fiscal year began on April 1st, but Governor Kathy Hochul and the state legislature have been passing budget extenders to be able to keep paying the state's bills. They've passed another extender on April 11th and are hoping to get a deal done the week of April 15th, coming up soon. Everybody's sort of hoping that a state budget will be in place by when Passover arrives a week later after April 15th. So the week of April 15th is being eyed as the key week for getting a state budget deal done. Negotiations have been ongoing. The state budget will come in at somewhere around $235 billion for the fiscal year that has now begun. There are many, many tax and spend decisions to be made there, many funding decisions to be made still by the governor and the legislature, but also a lot of policy being negotiated as part of the budget deal. So a lot for the parties to still agree on, but we know they have been making progress as the governor and her team, the state Senate Majority Leader Andrea Stewart-Cousins and her team, and the Assembly Speaker Carl Hastie and his team have all been negotiating with many legislators involved. Of course, one of the biggest pieces remaining is coming to an agreement on a many-tentacled housing policy deal. Progress is apparently being made in those negotiations, but they still need to get to a final deal. And there's still a chance that housing policy, because a lot of it does not have a fiscal impact, may be kicked out of the budget into the legislative session to follow. But it seems like they're really trying to get a deal on housing as part of the budget that is overdue now. So speaking of housing policy in the budget, coming up in just a couple of days on Monday, April 15th at New York Law School, I'll be hosting a conversation for a live audience with New York City Deputy Mayor Maria Torres Springer. She's the Deputy Mayor for Housing, Economic Development and Workforce. And we're going to be talking about the Adams administration's state housing policy agenda and what the city wants to see from a state housing deal and how it fits into the city's larger plans around housing. So there's still time to RSVP and join us on Monday morning, April 15th at New York Law School. The event starts, doors open at 8:30. The event is 9 to 10 a.m. You can still RSVP by finding the form at citylandnyc.org if you'd like to join us. Another big piece of the puzzle in state budget negotiations, and this is always true, is healthcare spending and policy, especially Medicaid, which is, along with education aid, always one of the two biggest portions of the state budget. Medicaid is the federal program to provide healthcare to low-income and disabled people. It's administered by New York with a great deal of federal support, but also a lot of state spending. State spending on Medicaid will be over $30 billion this fiscal year. There are more than 7.5 million New Yorkers, that's more than a third of the state's population, enrolled in Medicaid. Healthcare needs and Medicaid spending have been growing rapidly in recent years, of course, accelerated around the pandemic and how that threw so much related to healthcare and health needs into even greater flux. Governor Hochul announced in her agenda unveiled in January that she was planning to take on the challenges related to state spending on Medicaid and challenges around areas of growth in that spending that have really accelerated in recent years. But there's been pushback to her savings plans from the legislature and others, and there are a number of related funding and policy debates happening among the parties at the state budget negotiating table and those influencing those negotiations. The Medicaid negotiations are not all, when it comes to health policy and funding, that's being debated, not to mention even mental health care is almost, you know, in a related but separate issue, often being negotiated somewhat separate from some of the other Medicaid and healthcare policies, but a lot of overlap there. So today on the show, my guest is State Senator Gustavo Rivera. He's a Bronx Democrat who is the chair of the State Senate Health Committee. He will join me shortly to discuss state budget negotiations, especially around a series of health care policy and funding issues. Senator Rivera has been a regular repeat guest on the show and always is an interesting legislator to interview. He's part of the Democratic supermajority in the Senate that's negotiating with the Democratic supermajority in the Assembly and the Democratic governor and her team on a budget that is expected, as I said, to come in somewhere in the neighborhood of $235 billion. It could even be up around $240 billion. Senator Rivera has been in the state Senate since 2010. He represents the 33rd district in the Bronx, which has taken on a pretty new shape since the recent redistricting. He represents the Bronx neighborhoods of Kingsbridge Heights, Fordham, Belmont, Riverdale, Norwood, Bedford Park, Pelham Parkway, Van Ness, Morris Park, and parts of Allerton. His district is roughly in its total population, roughly 57% Hispanic, 17% Black, and about 17% white, as well as 6% Asian. It's the sort of middle to northwest of the Bronx. And again, like I said, took on a pretty different shape in redistricting, and Senator Rivera had to win a very contested Democratic primary to wind up retaining that seat last election cycle. He's up for re-election again this year with the entire legislature, but it does not seem at this time here in April, with the primaries just a couple months away, that he's going to face a real challenge in the primary again, as he's done had to face in several cycles. Senator Rivera is chair of the Senate Health Committee since Democrats took over the majority in 2019 after their wins in the 2018 elections. Notably, as part of the context for this discussion, he is the lead Senate sponsor of the New York Health Act. That's the legislation that would move New York toward a single-payer healthcare system. It's been the goal of more progressive Democrats for many years. And as I'm sure you'll hear from Senator Rivera, the goal helps inform his broader outlook on healthcare policy in New York, which of course has many, many pieces to it, including things like managed long-term care, personal home care assistance programming, and like whether undocumented New Yorkers can enroll in the state's health insurance program, and much, much more. Home care in particular, by the way, has been really sort of exploding as people have sought care in their homes. The population is aging. There's sort of been a move among patients and providers towards more home care versus group settings like nursing homes. So that's been one of the biggest trends in healthcare in New York, and I believe beyond, in recent years. Before I bring Senator Rivera on, a couple other very quick things. If you missed any recent episodes of the show, check them all out here at Max Politics after you listen to this one. I've had a series of interesting conversations about the New York state budget negotiations and more. Recent guests have included the state Senate minority leader, Republican Rob Ort, about his conference's budget priorities and ways they're trying to influence the budget outcomes, even though they are in the minority. I've also recently spoken with expert guests about topics like artificial intelligence policy and the coming congestion pricing program. I've had on various other state legislators in recent weeks and months to discuss key aspects of budget negotiations. That includes Assembly members Catalina Cruz of Queens and Brian Cunningham of Brooklyn, among others. State Senate Deputy Leader Michael Janaris of Queens joined me as well, and still additional legislators. So check them all out in the podcast feed after you listen to State Senator Gustavo Rivera today. Before I bring him on, I can't go into all the needed background on some of what we'll discuss today. Of course, like with any of these other discussions I have with guests, you can find news coverage at some of the great outlets we have covering New York politics and policy. There's really good health coverage across a variety of outlets, but you can look to Politico New York for some of their coverage, especially that I rely on sometimes. The Albany Times Union has good coverage on some of these issues, among other outlets. You'll hear certainly Senator Rivera will go into, I'm sure, some background on some of the key policies that we're discussing, but this is an issue that might be the most complicated of any that we discuss related to the budget. And I will readily admit that I'm not an expert on health and healthcare policy. But like with many things, trying to get up to speed. And so we'll get into a lot of it with Senator Rivera. But just a few other quick notes on Medicaid and the state budget. As I said, there's more than 7.5 million New Yorkers enrolled in Medicaid. State spending on the program overall comes in at over $30 billion a year. And then there's federal matching dollars for that much, if not significantly more, I believe. Both the enrollment and the spending has increased a lot in recent years. Governor Hochul has been looking to find some savings that legislators are mostly opposed to in the Democratic supermajorities. Though I think that it's safe to say there's fairly broad recognition, and I'll get to this with Senator Rivera in just a moment, that more needs to be done to provide better care and to manage costs for people in Medicaid and more broadly, of course, in healthcare. And while even under Governor Hochul's plan, state spending on Medicaid would actually grow, she's also pushing to advance what she says would be a little over $1 billion in savings in the program. The legislature pushing back on that wants to seek new revenue streams. And I'll ask Senator Rivera about one in particular where the governor is actually on board with this, trying to appeal for new ways of bringing in healthcare-related revenue that would require a federal waiver. And there's some efforts to get that involved in the state budget negotiations. When she was unveiling her agenda in January, the governor said she was really taking on what she called spiraling costs around Medicaid and healthcare. She said Medicaid spending was exceeding projections this past fiscal year by $1.5 billion. She said that was in part because 200,000 more New Yorkers than anticipated had remained on state-funded Medicaid after the federal government ended its supplemental pandemic support. She also said, though, that part of the challenge in that state's area of spending was because the state had not gotten repayment of about $1.5 billion in one-time bridge loans made to financially distressed hospitals, which she said is actually about one-third of the hospitals in the state. So there's some real systemic challenges here around various aspects of healthcare and healthcare funding in New York that are really posing some real problems for people who need healthcare, of course, which is all of us, and then but especially the most vulnerable who rely on Medicaid, who often rely on these hospitals that are distressed. And there's some real discussions in the budget about what to do about this. They will probably do some short-term fixes, as they often do, but there's real questions about needing to do more long-term planning around Medicaid and around healthcare and around hospitals, and all the various expenses that go into providing healthcare. If you listen to my conversation with State Assembly Member Brian Cunningham of Brooklyn, you heard us discuss a bit about the issue with the SUNY Downstate Medical Center, and that's one of these hospitals that's really being looked at around its challenges with its fiscal stability. Governor Hochul said that the growth in state Medicaid obligations had increased 11% since the prior fiscal year, and that over 3 years, state Medicaid spending was up 40% in 3 years. So she said she was offering a few methods about how to save roughly $1.2 or $1.3 billion in Medicaid. She also said, though, that for longer-term planning, she had impaneled both the New York State Commission on the Future of Healthcare and the New York State Master Plan for Aging to help identify ways to improve the long-term care sector, by far the fastest-growing area of healthcare, in part, as I said, because of the state's aging population. So there's a lot to all of this, of course. Many stakeholders, from consumers and patients themselves to insurance companies and hospitals, other institutions, private institutions, nonprofits that are involved in healthcare, labor unions, of course, government entities at all levels of government, and more. All right. And as we speak here on Friday, April 12th, 2024, waiting for a New York State budget deal, I'm happy to be joined back on the show by New York State Senator Gustavo Rivera, a Democrat representing the 33rd State Senate District in the Bronx and the chair of the New York State Senate Health Committee. Senator Rivera, thanks for joining me again. How are you?
I am doing all right. And I assure you, Ben, we are waiting for a budget. It is not like waiting for Godot. The
Okay.
budget will arrive.
It will arrive. It is Friday, April 12th. Is it going to happen next week? There's
I really hope so. I think Look, it's obvious that there's been there's a lot of things that have been kind of up in the air. I'm glad to say that while these have been tough negotiations, they have not been acrimonious. I think there's been some progress made on small and medium-sized things, but there's still big things that are up in the air. There's certainly open issues in health that we're still fighting on. There's open issues in housing that we're still fighting on. Most of the stuff in education as most of it has been closed, but there's still some things that are open. But obviously, these are some of the big issues. But I'm glad to say that unlike last year, you might remember, there was this whole conversation that the governor had set a line in the sand and said, if we don't resolve the big issues, we can't talk about the small ones. That's not been the case. So there's a lot of small and medium-sized things that have been closed. Granted, the big issues are still unresolved, but I feel confident that we're making some level of progress. And that over this weekend, the leader and the senior staff will come to a conclusion on some of these things, and they'll be able to vote on a budget by next week.
I'm glad you brought up last year, because I was actually listening back the last time we spoke here on the program. You came on right after the budget deal was reached last year, and we talked about, your evaluation of the budget and things that you and the state Senate majority had fought for or fought against, things you were happy with, things you were upset about. And one of the biggest things that you were very frustrated about last May was how the governor had approached the budget process. Do you think Governor Hochul and her team have done a better job with how they've interacted with the legislature this budget process? How do you sort of compare that? And do you think that sort of the challenges between the governor and the legislature that were so dramatic last year around especially with the state Senate around the governor's initial nomination for chief judge, holding up the budget for bail reforms again and some other things. Has this year been a lot smoother and more collaborative? Are there still major challenges? What's your sort of assessment in terms of that balance and that process and how the governor and her team are handling the budget negotiations?
Well, as I said, the budget is still a tough budget to negotiate. However, I would say that it has been better than last year. It's just the frustration last year had to do more with the process than with the pol than with the policy differences. And then when you take both of those things and you mix them together, you're like, we don't agree on what we ultimately need to do, and we're not agreeing on how it needs to be done. Then it really is like, then it's incredibly frustrating. So this year, again, as I said earlier, we have been dealing with small and medium-sized things, and closing them and agreeing on them and going forward. So we can look at the list. If you look for anybody who's ever done this type of work, every budget bill has parts to it, right? Part A, part B, part C, and then you keep going down until in a place like the health budget, there's like double D, the part double C, part double D, part double E, so it's like it has so many different parts. And I would probably say that in the case of the health piece, there's probably like 70% of it that's closed. Like we just that means that we've small and medium-sized things we'd agreed upon, but the big ones are still there and we're still fighting them. So at the core of it, the process has been better. The process has been not as acrimonious as last year. And not as frustrating as last year. The policy side, there's some places where the governor is resisting movement, that are a little frustrating, but that just has to do with the fact that we disagree on things. So I will expect that second part. I'm just glad that the first part is a little bit better.
What would be an example of that in terms of where you see some of the biggest differences and challenges right now that are sort of the outstanding? Obviously, there's things we need to dig in on the specifics on health and on housing and other issues, but what would you cite for people are a couple of the biggest challenges here that are the big gap between the legislature and the governor?
Well, the governor's insistence on cutting Medicaid seems very perplexing to me, and very frustrating to me, to be honest. I mean, first of all, the governor is insisting on about $1.2 billion in cuts to the system that I think has been underfunded for a very long time, and then leaving money on the table at the same time. For example, we've talked about this before, coverage for all. The notion that right now there are The state just in 2022, I think, is a there was a latest numbers. The budget, the state of New York spent about $860 million, which is about $430 million of state share in emergency Medicaid. That is for particularly for undocumented people who are human, therefore they're going to get sick, they wind up in emergency rooms, and we pay for their care with emergency Medicaid. So this is an expenditure that we are already incurring. And based on a big fight that we had last year, as you might remember, there's clarity from the federal government. We actually wrote them a letter and they responded saying to us that they would give us somewhere up to about $430 million worth of federal money that we could use to extend the essential plan, so basic health coverage, basic health insurance, to undocumented people. So it would be a savings of hundreds of mil potentially hundreds of millions of dollars. Well, the governor doesn't want to do that for some reason. And it is perplexing because at the same time, she is not seeking federal assistance for something that we were told we can get that money and for which we are already spending money. Emergency Medicaid is something that we spend every year. So whether and the implementation of the of coverage for all would mean savings, period. Would it be savings? They're saying maybe it's not $430 million. Okay, then maybe it's just 400, or maybe it's just 300. It's just $50 million. It would signify savings to the state, and the governor's still not seeking it. So there's things like that, and also some of the changes that she is suggesting to a program like CDPAP, which is the Consumer Directed Assistance program. This is a program where people, for example, with physical disabilities, that are disabled but still have certain all their mental capacities and are able to communicate, can hire the person that takes care of them, like a home care worker, but have that person be, for example, a family member or what have you, and they self-direct it. So consumer directed, it means that they are, hey, help me get into bed, help me do this, et cetera, et cetera. So that program, which was innovated in the state of New York, the governor's insisting on cuts to it that are very concerning because it impacts very vulnerable populations. So those are just two of the things on the top of my head that I'm very confused and perplexed about.
Well, let's stick with this stuff then. Let's dig in a little bit more on those two things and the broader Medicaid picture, because obviously this is a huge portion of the state budget. The state spending well over $30 billion at this point annually on its share of Medicaid expenses, and then at least that much typically from the federal government, if not more, coming in to match. So when you say, the governor is looking to make cuts, she's saying spending growth is unsustainable and we need to at least find some areas of savings here. And there's a variety of mechanisms on that. When we've spoken in the past, you've said there does need to be real evaluation of a lot of different pieces of how the state spends money on healthcare. You just got it one that you're pushing for with coverage for all, which again, you cite the possibility of actually cost savings to the state on that, extending the essential plan to undocumented New Yorkers
With
who
federal
need that
money.
healthcare with federal money. Where does the discussion need to be in terms of looking at an explosive growth, continued growth in state spending on Medicaid, and having some recognition that it's not sustainable to keep growing at these high percentages year over year? How do you balance that? Because she's talking about a very modest, relatively modest amount of overall savings, but the challenge, of course, is anytime you're doing that is like, where exactly does it come from, right? But she's convening or reconvening task forces and all this stuff. But how big picture here, how should this be approached? Because generally speaking, it seems like the legislature is mostly saying we just need to find ways to increase funding and keep increased funding without a lot of sort of attempts to manage the cost growth.
Okay, so there's a lot there. So let's back up for a second. Let's think about the fact that during the entire time that Cuomo was the governor, there was in every single budget cycle, there was a battle about Medicaid because it was all leading with austerity. And let's think about what that actually does. Remember that Medicaid is an insurance product for poor working class folks around the state, partly funded by the feds, partly funded by the state, that mostly goes to hospitals, federally qualified health centers, etc. And most of these hospitals that go, the places where it goes to, are hospitals that are geographically located in places where poor working class people, most of the people of color around the state, are, right? So we underfund Medicaid, and we have done it for over like a generation at this point, which means that when a patient walks in through the door of one of these institutions across the state, that institution loses money immediately because we do not pay them for the care that they are providing. Now think about what that does over a generation. This investment means that these institutions have to rely on us more. This is the paradox here. Because we have quote unquote saved money, and this is what Cuomo insisted on doing over his entire tenure, what we did was underfund a system which serves the most vulnerable around the state, and institutions, which I will tell you, and I'm sure that we're going to talk about this, all across the state are falling apart and then coming back to the state for help on an emergency basis because they're running out of cash or their freaking elevator doesn't work anymore. So what we're looking at a picture that's very, very small and immediate and not thinking about the long-term solutions here. The type of things that I'm talking about, the expenditures, are not about expenditures. They're about investments. They're investments to provide stability to a system that, unless we invest in it, will grow in ways that have to do more with emergency situations than maintenance. See what I'm saying? So the type of things that I'm talking about, I'm not just some crazy tax and spend liberal. Like, probably somebody will accuse me of that, and that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it's we have to spend more because we have to invest more. We have to do it in a smart way, certainly. But investing in a system that has been disinvested in for a long time, to me, makes sense. When an institution, and again, I've gotten, since I became the chair of the health committee, what, 6 years ago, I think, that means that I'm getting calls from colleagues all over the state, across party lines, telling me, hey, Hospital X called me yesterday. They're going to have to close this, or they're going to have to do this, or they're going to have to, they're in an emergency situation. This is, happens all of the time. It is the way that the state has operated the system for so damn long.
Mm-hmm.
And so with the type of things that I'm talking about, once again, does it need to be done in a smart and effective way? Yes. But we can't say, like, cutting doesn't mean that the folks who need these services are going to go away. By doing savings, that you insist on calling them that, not you, the governor insists on calling them that, the budget folks insist on calling them that, they are cuts. And they are cuts. If you cut nursing homes, if you do not right-size Medicaid rates, if you cut programs like CDPAP, or you cut wages for home care workers, what do you think is going to happen? Do you think that the folks who need these services are going to disappear all of a sudden?
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't some of this discussion about how the state, it's not exactly necessarily about direct cuts to services. It's about all of the different pieces around who's managing what services, and when you get certain companies and providers involved. And it's not necessarily saying we want to cut direct services to people. Your point obviously is taken, but it's about sort of how the overall system is run and how certain, parts of it are contracted or insurance companies and managing.
There it is.
Right. This is why I don't quite understand why the legislature and the governor can't work together for a longer term plan to rein in some of these costs and, to try to figure out how to provide good services for the people who need it. Obviously, as you say, the most vulnerable people, the lowest income people, disabled people across New York State, but in a way that's more cost effective for the state. And it seems to me that you have, as you're about to talk about, you have the power of insurance companies, then you also have the power of hospitals, you have the power of the labor unions, and you have most of these sort of quote unquote special interests that are mostly the ones actually dictating policy, whether it's having the governor's ear or having the legislature's ear. So how, you know, how do you sort of break? We keep having this conversation year after year, basically. So how do you break that? Go. Fix it for us.
First of all, sir, I'm working on it.
Yes.
First thing is that.
And let's not talk about the New York Health Act right now, because.
Really?
That's
really.
It's
I'll
not.
Hold on a second. It'll take me 10 seconds on that, and then I'll move on to other things. Okay.
Fine. But just to be clear, you Democrats have had control of both houses of the legislature since 2019. The New York Health Act has not moved. Everybody was promising Democrats take over both houses. You know, this is going to be on the agenda. So temper. I know you are pushing for it. But,
indeed,
you know,
I am.
In the realistic world here that we seem to be living in around this policy, it doesn't seem to really be on the table as a long-term solution. But you can
first of all,
correct
it is.
Me if I'm wrong.
Okay. No, you are wrong. And I'm sorry. Okay. I'm sorry to correct you, sir. But it is absolutely on the table.
You're the policymaker. Go ahead.
It is absolutely on the table as a long-term solution. But I'm not going to deny that it's incredibly incredibly complicated, both from a political and a policy side. But the reason I'm only going to refer to it generally is because you are correct that it takes a longer conversation. I should tell you that at some point we should have a conversation about it, because there has been some movement in some of the internal conversations that I've been having about it, which I think that there's a momentum that's building, but that's a different conversation. As a longer term solution, the New York Health Act is an absolute centerpiece of it, because it moves away from. It transitions to a single payer system, which actually addresses many of the issues that we're talking about here. But if we're talking about things that are more immediate, there are things that legislatively we can do. And this is where, for example, a bill that I introduced just this year on getting rid of managed long-term care plans. So there's long-term care patients and there's MLTCs, or managed long-term care plans, that were put into effect as supposedly to make the system more efficient and effective and potentially save us money. And they were put into effect after the initial Medicaid redesign team back in 2011. Mm-hmm. That has been a failed experiment. I think that there's a demonstration that what insurance, what these insurance companies, middlemen do, as insurance companies do, their business model is not to provide you care. That is not what insurance companies do in the managed long-term care space or in the normal healthcare space. Their business model is denying you care to keep more of your money. And moving away from MLTCs, I think, is a way to get to do that. Now, remember that when we're talking about the and there's also, as it relates, for example, to hospitals, there's a bill I just introduced related to hospital closures, because I do think that there needs to be a more thoughtful way to do this. If certain institutions need to transform, then we need to have them. We need to have that transformation actually correspond to the, actually be have be informed, I should say, by the individuals, by the communities that are going to be impacted by the changes in that healthcare institution. So I think that we need to talk about here, this is, we're trying to deal at the core of it is the issue of the fact that healthcare is viewed as a commodity. And that's a longer term and much more kind of, that's a philosophical issue, but one that impacts everything across the way. But I do believe that there's things that we can do to cut away at that. And as it relates, for example, like paying people more makes sense. That's an increased cost, but paying people more makes sense, because these folks not only provides more stability to them, but it means that actually more money comes into the economy when people get paid more, particularly folks that are in the low end or the middle end of the income bracket, if you will. But it's like but the first question that you ask is an important one. I absolutely believe that the legislature and the executive should work together on longer term solutions. I am open to that. I'm open to it around issues of workforce. I'm open to it around issues of safety net institutions, like systems designs, like all these types of things are absolutely. I want to deal with it as a longer term issue. Like sometimes it doesn't work out like that. I'm saying it both publicly and privately. This is what I was trying to do last year that I'm still in the process of doing as it relates to workforce, for example. I did a tour around the state, traveled to Buffalo, Rochester, Syracuse. I probably did a couple more stops. I don't remember, but there was Binghamton, and it was around issues of workforce issues in that particular part of the state, with all stakeholders involved, whether we're talking about providers, workers, local elected officials, etc. And the goal was to kind of develop a series of like real-time solutions to these things that then we could come and implement in policy, be it legislative or potentially, have the governor implement things administratively. These are still kind of things that are in progress, but longer-term solutions are absolutely necessary and essential. There are some things that we can do in the state that I believe we are doing. So, that's a long and drawn out, kind of thing, but it's something, trust me, I think about this stuff every day.
And in terms of a couple of specifics that I want to get to on things that seem to be very live in the budget negotiations. So, in terms of home care for elder New Yorkers, people with disabilities, that spending and those enrollments and that part of state Medicaid spending has really been increasing significantly in recent years. Is there anything that's going to be done in the budget to address those rising costs or bolster that program in any way? I mean, what's happening in budget negotiations around what to do about home care?
There's certain changes that there's certain cuts that the governor's proposing that we are opposed to, and this is relationship certainly to what's happening in as I talked about earlier, CDPAP program, the Consumer Directed Assistance Program. There's some cuts that the governor's proposing there, and we're opposing those. It's there again. We just some of these things are just.
But you oppose that, and but you don't you you're opposing any changes at this point, right? That
No,
would
that's
be
not what
for
I'm saying. No,
you.
no, no, no,
Oh,
no, no.
okay.
That's not what I'm saying. There is, for example, there's these entities called fiscal intermediaries or FIs, right? Fiscal intermediaries are meant to be, for example, for consumer-directed assistance. You had individuals who might not be, they're just not experienced in paperwork, and but they need to get paid. So the FIs or fiscal intermediaries were created as a way to have state dollars flow through them to actually go down to the folks who are actually providing the care. Unfortunately, the way that we structured that program, and we certainly can make changes when we need to, and we need to now, that made it so that they proliferated to an extent that is just unsustainable. So I agree that we need to reform the issues of fiscal intermediaries. We need to have it done in a way that, for example, keeps, whether we're talking about geographic balance or cultural competence. There's certain fiscal intermediaries that need to be that need to continue to exist. There are certain proposals out there which suggest that we should have just one for the entire state. I'm not a fan of that proposal. I think it does not make sense. And we're negotiating that right now. But do I believe that we need to actually seriously reform how fiscal intermediaries are allowed to have been allowed to proliferate? Absolutely. And we need to cut down on that. We need to make sure that we cut down on them, but we need to think about how we serve patients first. And so the way to serve patients well, I believe, is to balance that out by allowing both for geographic balance, so that there are fiscal intermediaries that correspond to a particular geography and to particular, and then demographically, there's some that might be able to work best with a community that's like for example, let's say a large Asian American Chinese community that is served by certain folks, or Spanish speaking community, et cetera, Orthodox Jewish in a part of the state, et cetera. So there's different ways that we can actually balance this out without just going down to one, which I don't think makes sense.
One of the ways that the legislature seems to want to help ensure that there's no reductions in state Medicaid spending is by having New York adopt a tax on managed care organizations. Modeled on something similar that's happened in California and maybe elsewhere, that would help unlock billions more in federal Medicaid funding. There is the need to get federal approval to do this.
Yep.
Where does that stand? Obviously, the governor actually was just in DC the other day. So I don't know if you've gotten any sense of whether that came up in a meeting she had with the White House. I know that that was potentially on the agenda, along with things related to the asylum seeker migrant crisis in the state. So where does that attempt to get a federal waiver to for New York to adopt this tax on managed care companies and unlock billions of dollars that could go into Medicaid spending, by the way, potentially only for short amount of time?
For a couple of years. That's actually progressing. Mm-hmm. And for those folks, so that folks understand what we're talking about, there is a way for us to be able to tax managed care organizations and have that money, that tax then be matched by federal dollars, so that then we can reinvest that into the Medicaid system. And it's something that was done, as you mentioned, by California recently. And it's clear that feds are like, the feds were like, wait a minute, that obeys, it's within the parameters of our regulations, but it might be stretching it a little bit. We're in conversations with them. But they're basically with the way that we're looking at this, that we haven't actually made the request official yet, because we'd have to negotiate it. We're negotiating it during the budget so that then we can actually make the request officially. But I feel pretty confident that the short version is that the conversations are proceeding. There are issues about timing. There's issues about the amount of money that we could potentially get from the feds. All that stuff is still in flux. It's unlikely that we'll be able to achieve the $4 billion that we thought we were originally going to get. Mm-hmm. Part of it is that, in the case of California, for example, this is the type of thing, so that folks understand, when we're talking about federal waivers, these are basically just permission to use Medicaid or Medicare dollars in different ways, right? And so different states have different ones. In the case of California, they already had a waiver for an MCO tax already in the books before they did this current change. And so therefore, it was much easier for them to transition into a new, you know, to transition to the new waiver. For us, we'd have to start from scratch. So what the bottom line for us, what that means is that we would not be able to get the revenue immediately. Like, we wouldn't be able to get it, like, you know, this, you know, in the next couple of months. So it's all about when the money would potentially flow and how much it would flow. And as you said, it is a short-term solution. It is, there's potential, and the feds have already said that they would change some of the regulations at the federal level so that this would not be possible in a couple of years. But as a short-term solution, like, I'd be fine with being able to use it for a couple of years. I think that there's longer-term solutions, like capital gains tax, which is a bill that I carry that would give us between $8 and $12 billion of revenue, new revenue, that is. So that's the type of thing that I think we should pursue in the long term. But in the short term, this can work. And we're working, the legislature is working with the executive, and those conversations are ongoing. And there's unofficial conversations with the feds about how all this was to be structured to make sure that we're, you know, that everything is copacetic before we pull the trigger.
And so the idea here is it's a potential way of unlocking additional revenue to support growth in Medicaid in various ways without having to consider some of these cuts.
Growth or stability. Seek stability. That's what I'm...
Again, stability relative to the fact that costs continue to rise. Now, costs in many cases are always going to continue to rise, right? There's almost always inflation, wages increased, et cetera, et cetera. You know, there's ways to find perhaps savings, but, you know, this is like talking about, you know, cutting the sort of growth curve in some ways, not necessarily, you know, talking about actually reducing spending, although there's some people obviously who want to have that conversation.
Yep.
Okay. So your sense, though, is this is something that is very likely moving forward.
Yeah.
You will book some amount of revenue in this budget, or it will not.
In this fiscal year. Yes.
Yeah.
But the timing of that is still, it
could be second half of the fiscal year that you anticipated or something like that.
There you go.
But you're crafting a budget in all likelihood on the health side that includes some of this revenue, and therefore trying to take off the table some of the push for certain savings or cuts.
That is correct.
Okay. Few more things before I let you go here. Coverage for all is as you indicated earlier, that when we spoke a year ago, a little less than a year ago, after you had a budget deal, the number one area where you were expressing frustration was on this issue of coverage for all. We're still now having this conversation where you're saying the governor has not come around. Is it your anticipation, without getting into a full discussion further of this, is it your anticipation right now that this is still unlikely to be in this in the budget, given the governor's opposition?
Yeah, it doesn't look too good for the budget right now, but we are trying. But we did pass it in the state Senate last year, and I know that my colleague in the assembly is making some progress. Jessica Gonzalez Rojas, who's the sponsor in the assembly, is making some progress on potentially passing it over there. So it is, it is my hope that we can pass it both in the Senate and the assembly, and then put it on our desk and then have conversations about it then.
Again, this is extending the state's essential plan to undocumented New Yorkers.
And using federal money, not state money to do it. Yes.
This bill that you mentioned that you carry in the Senate around insisting on a certain process around hospital closures, is that looking promising? It's passed in the state assembly. Is it going to be?
We're definitely having conversations about it. The bottom line for me on this one is that there needs to be involvement by the communities that are going to be impacted by whatever changes happen in a healthcare institution. And look, I understand that healthcare institutions need to transform themselves at times, but for example, what's happening right now in SUNY Downstate is a perfect example of the wrong way to do it. You can't have something happening kind of in a void, completely ignoring the folks that are going to be impacted, whether it's the providers, the patients, the workers. They need to be involved in the process. So we feel that it's necessary. Both Assemblymember Simon and myself, as well as many of our colleagues, feel that there needs to be more of an established process, and that's what this bill would seek to do.
And on SUNY Downstate, I talked about this here on the show with New York State Assemblymember Brian Cunningham, whose assembly district in Brooklyn includes the SUNY Downstate Medical Center. Is it your understanding that the legislature is pushing back on the governor's proposal around closing a portion of the SUNY Downstate complex, and sort of putting that off at least for now, because the Senate, at least, especially wanted to send some funds to SUNY Downstate and keep the hospital open and form a commission to figure out what to do about it? Is it your understanding that you're going to be able to sort of fend off more immediate action that the governor wanted to pursue?
The conversations are still ongoing on this. The way that we have looked at it, the way that some folks have approached it is, we have an opportunity during the budget to be able to appropriate a certain amount of money towards potential transformation, meaning the transformation of SUNY Downstate, and I believe that that's a very positive thing. We should go ahead and do that. We should appropriate that money and put it to the side. But before we dip into it, then there needs to be a process by which the community is involved. And I think that my colleagues in Brooklyn have made this very case quite clear. They've been quite loud and rambunctious about it. And I think that there's been some movement in our direction for a more reasonable change in that institution. Nothing is finalized yet, but I feel okay about where we are right now.
You, again, to revisit something we discussed last year, the second area you were most frustrated with last year's budget was the governor continuing again to oppose something you want to see related to how opioid settlement funds are used and whether they can be used in part to fund overdose prevention centers.
Yes.
Has anything changed on that?
Not on my end and not on her end, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. This is, again, for folks who might not remember, there's a bill that I passed a few years ago, which made it so that any type of settlement that is agreed upon or reached, I should say, with pharmaceutical companies that were partly responsible for exacerbating the opioid crisis that has occurred around the country, whatever lawsuits we resolved, the settlements would go into a fund, would go into a pot that could only be utilized for treatment, for harm reduction, and for recovery. And there's a board that was created specifically for the purpose of determining, of providing recommendations, expert recommendations, how this money should be used. And they have provided such recommendations. And the number one recommendation is that we use this settlement money, which is again not state dollars, but not taxpayer funds, but settlement money to actually support the work of the overdose prevention centers that are already operating. There's two of them in the city of New York right now, which have served, which have saved over 1,300 lives so far. But the governor has not done this, even though the recommendations are still there. We continue to push her, and we will continue to push her because it is, again, it is the right thing to do. These centers are already saving lives every single day. We should be able to, they should be able to extend the work that they're doing, and we should have some of these centers in other places in the state, certainly in my neighborhood too.
We can revisit that another time, but wanted to check in on the status of that. Obviously, so much more to discuss on many of these issues. And as you got it, we're going to have a conversation at some point solely focused on the New York Health Act. But last few quick questions. One, on the New York Health Act, you alluded earlier, I have to follow up on this. You alluded earlier that you feel like there's been some progress around those discussions that could lead to a breakthrough at some point here. Can you just give us a little insight into what you're referring to? Is this related to how certain labor unions view the bill, because that was obviously became a key piece of kind of the holdup around move trying to move it ahead, or something else.
That's certainly a part of it. I think that there's been some very, very productive discussions in the last couple of months that hadn't happened before. And I'm thankful for it because, as I've said all the time, there's always an open door. Me, my sponsor and my co-sponsor in the assembly and myself always have an open door to kind of whoever wants to engage in good faith to talk about how the bill should work better. And those conversations have happened in ways that I hadn't that hadn't happened before. So we're making some interesting progress, and we might have some stuff to further down.
And in terms of who those discussions are happening with or among, can you tell us, is that with labor or other entities?
With folks, well, we're always talking to everybody, but there are certain folks in labor that we're engaging with that are we're having just productive conversations with. So
All
I'll
right.
leave that there for the moment.
Okay, and before I get your just 1 minute take on where housing policy negotiations stand, last one on a health related item. There's a bill in the legislature. There's been a lot of sort of discussion, debate, controversy around the state studying its COVID pandemic response, and sort of evaluation for the next pandemic or major health crisis. The Governor Hochul ordered a review and hired a company to do it. That is behind schedule, but it's happening. And she's talked about wanting to see that report and get it out there. But there's a bill in the legislature that would establish an independent pandemic response study commission. Do you support that bill? And is there any chance of it passing this year?
It potentially could pass. It's one that I'm looking at. My colleague in the assembly who sponsors it, Jessica Gonzalez Rojas, and I are very close, and we've talked about this bill. There's just some issues in it that I think should be structured a little bit differently, but the notion of us having an independent assessment of what happened during that time and how best to make sure we do not repeat it, I'm certainly supportive of that. I'm certainly supportive of those efforts.
And I'll let you go on this. Give me your 1 minute or 2 minute take on where housing policy negotiations stand. This is obviously, as you got at very early in this conversation, one of the top issues that needs to be resolved. And obviously, one of the biggest crises, if not the biggest, facing New York State is housing affordability and housing availability. So where do those negotiations stand as we speak here on Friday, April 12th?
It's been a tough one because there's a the balance that has to be struck in between, and this is where it's always difficult to reach this balance, but the balance is between what new constructions need to happen and what do we do to make sure that people who currently have a home can keep it, right? So keeping people in their homes and making it available and having the current housing stock that's available continue to be available and afford to be affordable, at least for most folks. And how do we build new affordable housing stock? Both of those things, the balance is very, very difficult to reach. And I know that we've had some rough conversations, but what I think we have, there's a general consensus in our conference that that tenant protection needs to be at the core of this. And those have been the conversations that our leader has been having with the governor and the speaker. And I think that we've made some progress. There's been some places where we've gotten stuck, and there's no lie about that. But I do feel that there's definitely a consensus in our conference that protecting tenants is an incredibly important piece of this. That whatever we do to achieve that balance, as I said, of maintaining people in their homes and building new structures, that going back on what we were able to achieve in 2019, and those historic, that historic bill that protected tenants, we're not going back there. We're not going back to behind before that. So I do believe that there's some progress is being made, but it has been rough going. And the thing that has held up most of the conversations, but I think we might be close to a conclusion here.
And your general sense is that there will be a fairly significant housing policy deal in this budget.
I believe so. Listen, there's compromise is necessary. I understand that compromise is necessary to be able to achieve anything this big. And I think that there's many of us who understand that, the leader uses the word, she wants to make everybody happy-ish.
Happy dish, yeah.
If there's somebody, and I do have to give it to her again, because I don't think there's many people that could actually pull off what she's been able to do. Not only to, this is Andrea Stewart-Cousins, not only to be able to have what is a diverse, and certainly with some knuckleheads in her conference, myself very much included, the fact that she's able to manage all of our personalities and all of our demands, and be able to reach consensus within the conference or as close to it as possible, and then carry that into negotiations that could sometimes be very tough. There's very few people who could do it, as with her level of intelligence and class. And if it wasn't for her, I don't think we'd be able to reach one. But I think that we'd be able to reach a deal, and have something that makes everybody happy-ish.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, that's a much nicer way to put it. They say one of the hallmarks of a good compromise is everybody's unhappy, right? But that's a good, happy-ish is a much
It is
nicer
a,
way to
this
put
is the this is what if you didn't know about that, like Andrea is a is, there is a freaking silver lining everywhere. Like it's just it's some she's just a positive thinker, which sometimes somebody is, like myself, sometimes finds annoying, but it's why I love her, because this is why
She
she has the
brings
job that she
you,
has, and I have the job that I have. She's a positive thinker, so she's like, I'll make everybody happy-ish. That's
Hey,
just.
listen, the governor has been very focused on the question of building more housing and supply, and she said the other day something about wanting to get on board with protecting against rent gouging, which obviously was a big nod to pieces of Good Cause Eviction. So it seems like, I mean, it seems like there's been some real movement on the governor's side coming closer to where the legislature has been, including the state Senate, obviously, around insisting on some pieces of the Good Cause bill, at least. And obviously there's been reporting in the New York Post and elsewhere that there are some specifics coming together on a compromise around that. So
Yeah, and that's what, the devil is always in the details. And I will also say that that's just it is, the people who are involved in that, whether it's the leader, our senior staff, Brian Kavanaugh, who's our chair of housing over in the Senate, excuse me, and who is the wonk of all wonks. Like he's like if you want to know what's in the seventh paragraph of the 12th page of the subsection and why that word was chosen in that paragraph, Brian will freaking tell you. So they're diving deep into this, and they're figuring out what the details are. But I trust that they have the best interest of, certainly the folks that have been doing it on behalf of the Senate, have the best interest of tenants and New Yorkers in mind. And I believe that we will reach a compromise that will make everybody happy-ish.
there we go. We'll let you go there. Thank you for all the time. New York State Senator Gustavo Rivera, a Democrat from the Bronx and the chair of the Senate's Health Committee. Appreciate the time and thoughts. Thank you. Good luck wrapping this budget up, and we will check in with you down the line.
Thank you so much, good sir. We'll be
All right.
talking
Be
soon.
well.